Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. I'm your host, Katie Kangas, and each week on this show, we talk about how to take flight and follow your dreams as a solopreneur architect. In this episode, I talk with Damaris Mello Jay-Z, founder of Design by Mello, a practice rooted in curiosity, inclusion, and just plain fun. Damaris did not set out to become an entrepreneur. She pursued growth within multiple firms, trying to reach her full potential. But she found herself longing for more inclusion, more recognition, and just better alignment with people she worked alongside each day. So in the middle of life's challenges, she chose to build what she couldn't find. She launched Design by Mello, growing it into a small firm where she is able to reach her full height. Along the way, she lifts up her team members and encourages them to grow and thrive. Together, they serve community-centered clients with intention and care. Her firm operates at the intersection of affordable housing, inclusion, and long-term relevance in communities. These are not small or simple projects. They can rattle the bones of a neighborhood, they stir conversation, and they challenge convention. But Damaris navigates those community dialogues with clarity, keeping the focus on shared goals and the revitalization of these urban neighborhoods. The Jabberoo is the perfect bird to reflect the level of impact her practice has on urban environments. This is one of the largest flying birds in the Americas, and its distinctive silhouette naturally commands attention. Damaris designs for shifting demographics in urban economies. She doesn't just ask what a building looks like today. She asks people to think about designing for the community that they want to live in tomorrow. Damaris reminds us that buildings don't just impact the environment, they reflect the relationships we desire to have. Great urban developments shape spaces for a dynamic and inclusive neighborhood. Now dive in with me to this conversation with Damaris. Welcome to the Flying Solo Podcast. This week, I'm meeting with Damaris Mello Jay-Z, who is an architect here in the Twin Cities, but she practices everywhere, and she's built a beautiful practice focused on diversity and sustainability. And so welcome, Damaris.
Thank you, Katie. It's good to see you.
Well, why don't you tell us about Design by Mello?
Design by Mello, we are 7 years old. We are a commercial architectural firm. We mostly practice on affordable housing, mixed-use buildings, but we also do civic aviation. We just started getting our feet wet with healthcare, and we also do retail. But the main focus, if you think about revenue right now, is affordable housing in mostly mixed-use buildings.
That's an incredible need, a great niche to be filling. And you do that not just in Minnesota, not just in urban areas. Where else do you practice?
So we have had projects. Currently, we're very heavy in Minnesota, but we have had projects in Arizona and participated in some work in Nevada, Florida as well. And we might be going to Ohio soon here, Cincinnati, with affordable housing as well.
Nice. Anything drawing you back to your native Brazil?
Just vacation.
Oh, okay. Sometimes it's nice to have a project excuse to visit.
I've been joking with my clients when they call me, hey, they have a license in whatever place. I keep saying I have reciprocity through NCAR. I've been to Canada, Mexico, and New Zealand. So if you want to go to New Zealand, I'm here. So unfortunately, my license does not offer reciprocity in Brazil, but I do have a license in Brazil as well, since I was first an architect there.
Very fun. Oh, such an interesting practice that you've had. And you just built this 7 years ago. What are three words that describe Design by Mello?
We are curious. We never start a project assuming we know everything. We know how to do architecture, but we don't know what you need. So we need to know everything about you and the users and community to know how to apply our skills into creating such project. So if you're curious, we are very inclusive and we mean it. It's not just a jargon for us. We go for a very inclusive process. And I think we are fun.
Absolutely. I know you well enough to know that that's definitely got to be a value.
Got to be. And you have to, because think about, especially affordable housing projects, it is a 5-year process sometimes. Like the 3030 Nicolette's from PPL, it is literally our fifth year together. So if we don't like each other, if we don't have fun, that can be pretty brutal.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we have to be fun. We have to have, because we love what to do. Everybody in my team is an amazing, are amazing architects, and they have fun doing what they do. So we have fun. We have to be fun with, we have to have fun within us. We have to be fun to work with for our clients and consultants.
Very good. Can I ask more about that word inclusion? What does that mean to you? A lot of people throw that around, but it sounds like it's more integrated into the fabric of your practice. Can you describe that?
It is integrated in every way. My team. I am very careful to be inclusive with my team. When I'm not working with people, everybody I hire, mostly people that I hire come from big firms and very niche, as you know. We are put in a place where we're good at and we're left there. And they come in and there's almost a fear or even a lack of knowledge of the things they can do because nobody ever let them. So I am very purposeful that way. You have more to offer. And even if you make a mistake, just learn and move on to the next one. I am very inclusive in the process in the term. Like I don't ever give one person out the same things. And some people look at me scared, unless they tell me, like I have asked somebody to design a building for me. Are you good in design? Are you a good designer? Like, I don't know. Do you want to try? If they really ask me, please don't make me do this. That's okay. Then I won't. But if you want to try to see, if you don't even know you're a designer because you never were let to be, nobody ever let you be a designer. You don't know. So maybe you are great. You know. So we try. If it doesn't work, like, okay, maybe you stick with the technical thing. Another thing is conversation with clients. I make sure my team presents. If they did the work, they're presenting, not me. I do not like taking the credit for all the work they do. And it also goes into our clients. I want to hear, to listen to a fault sometimes. Sometimes there are too many forces pulling against each other. I have a current project that is being challenged that way. But we need to practice with our preaching, right? So I feel like if we don't listen to all voices, we won't be representing all the people that are part of the project, either as a user group or as a owner or as a stakeholder investor. So the inclusivity aspect of our practice is really including all voices and hearing all voices. And even if there are voices that cannot be heard or be delivered on, we need to also come back and talk about it. Like I know you mentioned A, B, C. We could not make B work. And this is why. I think that is as important as the things that we do. Mm-hmm. Because it feel like it was just unheard, right? Well, I mentioned something, nobody ever brought it back to me.
Exactly.
And I don't see any project. So I guess they didn't hear it. You know, we heard you, but here are the reasons why we couldn't. Sometimes, most of the time it's budget. But sometimes it's safety. Sometimes it's access. Sometimes it's complexity, right? It doesn't match that kind of program. But keeping the conversation going in a very considerate way, an inclusive way, is important to us.
I love that. Just a lot of touch points, a lot of interaction. You're not just closing out the world and sitting at your drafting desk. You are making this a conversation, a design around that conversation within the team and with your clients. That's a beautiful image for how to practice. I'm curious, is this a reflection on your career and experiences up to this point? What kind of personal strengths have you brought into this firm? And what are you hoping to accomplish with your own business that you weren't able to find at other places?
Everything I just mentioned, I couldn't find. And that was the reason I created this firm. I never wanted to be an entrepreneur. I did not want that for myself at all. I wanted to stay in a firm, climb the ladders, be a partner. I always wanted to be a partner in a firm. But I was never really allowed to take that path. I was never allowed to get outside of my comfort. I wanted to do something I had never done and was never allowed to because of budget and fees. We don't have the fee for it. We already have somebody else that's better at that. They can do that. And I was always staying that front end, client, design, ideation. And then I wanted to stay. I couldn't. I had to move on to the next client, the next design. And so I never was never able to do CDs. And I don't love it, but I always wanted to be in that space as well. So I also noticed sometimes in my case, I was allowed to be in the client's face spaces, but not all my team was. Mm. And I noticed that resentment that caused toward me even sometimes because I was the favorite, but not really because I am the front end, you are not, but I want to be where you are. Go figure, right? And you want to be where I am. So creating a more inclusive and a more holistic practice is my goal. And I never found it. And because I never found it, I created for myself. And when I created for myself, I struggled because I had to learn all the parts that nobody ever taught me. But then once I did, I was able to grow my team. And now I provide the same inclusive, holistic, comprehensive practice opportunity to people who come work with us.
That's great. So it sounds like your strength was that client interaction. And now your dream is bringing that skill to everyone.
Mm-hmm.
For those who aren't architects, what does that do for projects to be able to have everyone on your team communicating with the client?
For our clients, I mean?
Yeah, for the result of the project.
I think there's more opportunity for relatability, right?
Yeah.
You might not relate to me. I am high energy, maybe like, hold on, right? And I have people in my team that are more, so we have a diversity of personalities and skills in our team and comfort levels too. I'm very comfortable here with you. If I say, I'll tell one of my team members coming, he'd be like, well, why? What are you doing? Can I just go design the next building? And that is okay. I think some folks, because they are that way, some clients, they are more shy, more, you know, they prefer the conversation, the relationship with those folks. They vibe, right? Right? Like, it's, mm-hmm. So I think that provides those opportunities because I watch that happening, like clients navigate toward one or other staff.
And that's great because they may tell someone they connect with information that they may not feel comfortable saying. Like,
yeah.
Well, it would be silly to tell someone about a preference about a light switch or a door swing or mm-hmm. or cabinetry. And it's like, no, we want all of that. We want to hear it.
Yeah. And I feel like people that are, even though a lot of clients who prefer me, the moment they meet my team, they are very, they're great. And I have clients who call me and say, hey, we're not going to be in the meeting. Like, I don't need to be in that meeting anymore because... And they don't like that right away. And then eventually they're like, I see what you're saying. They are great. And they are, because I need to be able to scale. And if I stay on every project, in every meeting, in every role, I won't be able to scale. And I love delegating. I mean, again, to a fault, I will over-delegate if you don't tell me, I don't know how to do this. And I prefer that you just tell me, than to make you feel like I don't trust you and I don't trust that you can develop to a higher level. Because I learned most things on the fire anyways. I was asked to do stuff like, ooh, never done that before. So I'll try my best. If I get stuck, I come back and ask. And that's another part. I think for us, small businesses is important. Not everybody's a good fit for us. If you are, and I'm okay with that. Like, I have had people that I had to have to let go. And that was the conversation. Like, the personality type has to be different. You have to be an entrepreneur and a spirit to do well in small business, because you're gonna have to do everything. You're gonna have to wear every hat. And if you are honest with the guests, stuck every time you don't know one thing, I will look everywhere. Now we have ChatGPT now for us to ask. We can ask. Oh, before it was just Google. Now we can chat. We can, if you really don't find it, or if you're not secure in what you found, you ask, but don't stop until I ask you how's that going a week later to tell me. Oh, I didn't know how to do this. That's not, you have to be unafraid. And I know it's not a fair requirement when the leadership is stiff and punitive. But I always say, I don't know either sometimes. I might have to go call my retired friend and ask, hey, when you were working on this, how would you solve? I have peer groups that I call to ask questions about code, about constructability, about problems that I don't know how to solve myself. And then when they watch me being vulnerable and me, I don't know either. They are comfortable doing the same. So I know it's not a philosophy that's fair to expect in every work environment, but it's definitely fair to, you can make mistakes here. I just would rather you not do the same twice, but even if you do, we just need to move on quickly from it. I remember one of my best mentors said that to me, like, don't sit on a mistake more than 2 minutes. Like, come tell me, I'll help you solve it. And then you move on. Don't come back with the same mistake, but keep on moving. Because that, by the way, when you learn through a mistake, you're never going to forget. Ask me how I know.
That's so true. I've been there too.
The trauma is going to ingrain in your brain.
It does. Yeah, we almost learn more from failures than the success.
Oh my gosh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, this is incredible. And you're touching on why it's so important to share so many different stories of different architects, because we all have one title, but we practice so differently.
So differently.
And mm-hmm. that's a good thing for our clients, because we serve different types of clients and it takes different energy to complete different types of projects. So mm-hmm. specifically, what are the ideal clients and projects that you go for?
I want people who cares. And so it's kind of a broad, but I want people who care about impacts on communities, on their people, on environments. I think I had to do projects in the beginning of my business when I needed to pay the bills. Maybe I didn't have to, but I felt like I had to. I know we always have a choice. And I chose to do projects for folks who didn't care, because they have the bottom line is this profit. And it felt really more than transactional. It felt like almost a prostitution of my skills. Not almost like it felt like that. I felt like I was selling it for some, you know, for cash. And it felt very bad. I was asked even to not speak in community meetings, because I think the client knew that I lean more with the community than with them in that topic. So like, do not answer, like text mess, like do not answer. Because we were in the 2021, 2020 window and it was online. So we were in this community meeting online and people were asking, I want to ask the architect, don't answer. Like, but they don't answer, because they were aware of my values and what I would, that's a good point. If I was to answer that question, like, that's a good point. And so when that experience happened, it really reinforced my decision of, if whenever you can afford to say no, and you say yes to things that add to you, add to your team, add to your community. I know development, especially large scale, that we do large scale mixed use projects, there is always a negative. There's no la la land to think about, oh, you will create disruption. You increase traffic, you increase density, you increase potential problems that come with it. So if you are only extracting, God Lord, I don't want to be your architect. Let us balance that as much as we can with the ads. Bring something to the community that otherwise they wouldn't have with that product. There's already causing disruption. And there's a way not to. You will cause disruption. If nothing else, during the construction. But there's always going to be, if you have 100 families, new families in the one block, of course there's disruption there.
Absolutely.
So we're like, oh, we are giving a lot when you're giving especially affordable homes, but we're also creating disruption in the community. And when we do that, we need to acknowledge that our role in that and try to minimize long-term impact.
So it sounds like clients who care, no matter the project, that's what matters. But when you're in these meetings, I hear the phrase, not in my backyard.
Oh, all the time.
Do you have ways, like, do you have a strategy for addressing that issue?
I think another thing for a client perspective, like for when you're being asked of a client is asking you for a proposal or if you want to bring in that project, it's not hard to differentiate the two types. You look back and what they have done before, and if you don't know for sure, if you not know, if you are in a new city, you do not know. You can always ask other people who design their projects. But I feel like for the community, some stuff is just that simple. It's like hypocritical. Like, I agree that we need affordable housing, but they will never say, but just not here. They say everything else. They say, because it's going to create shade. It's going to increase cars. It's going to, they're never going to say, I just don't want to poor people in my neighborhood. If they were that open, it would be easier to dialogue, because then like, okay, and then you're just being hypocritical. And it's a city, it's a public space. We need to provide more homes to people. So the whole discussion about density even, yes, you go to Edina, for instance, you go to other neighborhoods, the large lots is nothing but to make sure you create an affordability for middle class and below.
So do you feel like you're educating a lot of communities in this way? Because otherwise you're just trying to bat down one little issue that you mentioned, shade or parking or more people in our quiet community. Instead of batting down every single little complaint, it sounds like you're realigning, help them see the bigger vision of what is it going to be like for more people to have affordable housing.
And access to the neighborhood. Because I mean, even here, I'm in Southwest Minneapolis, very close to a Starbucks, very close to banks and walkable distances. And I do live behind a church parking lot. And I always joke about it, like church, Catholic church parking lots. Ooh, it's going to be an apartment building soon, right? With the online churchgoers. And if that happens, would I hate it to see a building? Yes, I would not like to see a building. Hopefully it's beautiful. I hope I design it. But can I be whining at the community room meetings? No. I bought a home in a city, in this city, in a urban core. So when you do that, you need to be aware of the zoning code is leaning toward density because people need homes. Now, my chance would be to be in those 20, 40, whatever plan meetings and to advocate for no density then, which is still not fair because people need homes. But if I didn't have my voice heard there, I need to be, and that's the thing, there's opportunity for education. But I can just go so far as if you really anti-minorities, anti-lower income families, there's so much I can do. I'll have respect. I will be polite toward you. I don't know if I can respect that position, but I will be polite and I'll accept what you have to say, but I don't want to, I'm not going to practice that kind of exclusive and excluding and classicist approach. I was just one of those not that long ago, right? I was those that you were trying to keep away. So, I am at that core, I'm still, right? So I feel like even now, the situation going on with immigration, like I am them. I'm just three blocks down south.
Yeah.
That's the only thing that separates us is this shield. I just talked about this. Like, it's hard to be in this moment being protected in a way from your socioeconomics. But knowing that two, three turns in your life took you here instead of taking you there. And it's a mixed bag of feelings, to be honest with you.
It really is. It's been a lot. Just a lot going on in cities and conversations had about these topics, which probably needed to come to light earlier in a less critical moment so that we can have, boy, it helps when we have shared vision for our communities and what
broader visions, right? The shared broader visions. And then, yeah, we're never going to be happy about every single subvision of those, you know, our private needs, our preferences. Yeah. That should not be as important as the broader need of basic needs for our community.
And the potential for the urban fabric to be so enriched with these new voices, with this livelihood that is brought to these communities. Mm-hmm. That's so cool to hear. How do you find clients who align with your vision? Because these are big projects. Who are the people behind these huge projects and how are you connecting with them in a way that helps them choose your services?
I was going to say they find me because my first project for affordable housing was a PPL. And they had heard of me through staff and through community leaders. So when they went after the site, the Wells Fargo site, after the riots, and they won the RFP to be the developer, they started talking about who would be. And they actually were only developer who submitted a response to the RFP for this site to Wells Fargo without a design. They were the only ones. Everybody else had an architect design the building and they proposed. So, and they did that on purpose because they wanted to, we don't know what we're doing here. And we won't know until we talk to the community extensively. Because this, specifically that site, in the middle of the riots, there's a reason why this opportunity even is here. Is because there was some kind of conflict that we finally exploded on, right? Like this poof that happened. And then now we cannot just rebuild. We have to fix some things here. So they went in with a response that was pure narrative. Like this is what we're going to do. We're going to engage community truly. And we're going to then find the right partner. So when they start asking around, who would be the best, a good team for this? Everybody kept mentioning my name. And I didn't even know this until after. And then staff like, oh, there's this Brazilian architect. So it's like, well, isn't she like a solo practitioner or something? So I was a solo practitioner and I was offered a project that is about $66 million phase one, another good 50 mil second phase. We are doing both phases and we finished phase one now. Construction is finished, completed. We started designing phase two 2 years ago. But that's how it happened. And once that client found us through the message we had been sharing in community, right? And that's the thing. Sometimes you feel like you're just talking to walls, but people hear you and they might not register because it does not speak to them in that moment. But when there is a question about, do you know anyone who would X, Y, and Z? Like, oh, I heard somebody talking that about that in a conference, or I heard this woman in a panel, or I heard her in, you know, there was 3 points directing to me that then they called me and offered me the project. Once they hired me for that project, other people start coming to us with the same shared vision.
That's cool. And so being active and sharing your vision before you even had a client who was buying it, just putting that out there helped your message percolate through the community. That's great.
And I think one thing that is that we are not doing it too because we want to, the message was never about business. It was more about in architecture communities. Like when we start talking about the lack of diversity in our practice, what's important. When George Floyd was assassinated and all the uprising happened, I had even local firms reach out to me and say, I hear what you're saying. Like you have been saying this all along. So would you partner with us for this project? Because now our client is asking us to do better now. So I feel like if we're talking about it, this not because as a sale strategy, but because that's your heart. And it's like, I see this all day long. Like, this is not the way to do it. I think your voice is not going to come back empty. I think there's something about that. The universe is going to hear you and it might not register in the moment, like I said, because they are not relating to you in some ways. But then when there's a moment that it arrives, like, oh, I think I know who you need to meet. And I think that was, in a way, it's kind of funny. I was going to say, as a business owner, I try to expand, of course, my business. And as I'm like, okay, maybe I should build the relationships with X, Y, Z. It never vibe. It just doesn't vibe. Because if that core value is not there for both sides, it just don't vibe. So it becomes almost, self determining, like what relationships are going to be strengthened. Like for instance, a couple of other nonprofits and even a for-profit developer that really aligns with us. It's just such an easy click, we click. And even if there is no work for 2 years, we're just vibing a relationship. And when there is a project, it's ours. It happened to a nonprofit in town. Like, I don't know when, but never, my next project is yours. And 2 years later, they called me like, hey, remember I told you that? It's time. And that was because the values aligned. So when I try to expand and be like, maybe I shouldn't, our business mentors, when we do a small business training, they tell us, you need to not be like that. You need to have, yes, your values, but you need to have at least a percentage of your business like cash calls. Then you go to the cash call potential clients and they're like, it doesn't feel right. It just feels like, again, it goes back to feeling transactional and dirty because your hearts are not aligned. I have tried to, okay, let's just go after this thing. I was never successful to begin with. Maybe because my heart was not there. It didn't help me, but it is a mission-driven business. Maybe I should stay with the mission-driven relationships. And yeah, if I never grow to be 100 people, that's all right.
And that fits. You're filling that need in your community. You're filling a need in architecture services. And you're creating a place for architects who want to serve in this way.
Exactly.
And so, not every business needs to become a conglomerate.
Global, yeah.
But it can be exactly what you need it to be for your practice, for your life, mm-hmm. and for the clients you serve. That's
for my team. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, can I share a bird with you that I think aligns?
Yeah.
Well, I think it's the jabiroo, and it's a bird that is from Brazil, but it travels all over, which I felt was really aligned with the way that your practice does migrate to different parts of the country and different parts of the world, potentially. And it's a large bird. And I feel like there's a lot of small firms. There's a lot of sole practitioners that I talk with that are more small projects, small things. You do the big ones. And a jabiroo is a 5 foot tall bird. And it's collaborative in that they do nest with others, but they do mate for life. And that feels like that commitment that you're making to your clients to build something that lasts. Mm-hmm. But the fact that they do migrate means that they are adaptable to so many different environments. And that feels like you going to a community and thinking about each community and building that nest with them in mind. You're working with them and making those projects happen in a way that reflects them. And so those are some of the reasons I think that you're like this guardian of urban spaces.
Yes. And I love the adaptability part, because I think that is something that I have always been proud of my ability to adapt. So much so I moved here from Brazil and then to Arizona and then here, right? And then I started from a big, large firm, from only big, large firms. I started my own, which was very much of a shock. And that nimbleness, you need to be nimble, you need to be able to adapt, it has carried me through to this day, right? Through a lot of things in personal life, professional life. You got to be adaptable and you got to be able to be nimble.
I love that, because that's kind of why I use birds as an analogy, because they have to be so slim to keep flying. You've got to be very balanced with how much you're eating and where you're stopping and how you're living your life. You have been flying solo, even though your firm right now is not one person. Mm-hmm. I feel like the way that you've had to navigate and make decisions along the way, you have carved your own path. And it's really that vision of a bird that is way up in the air flying, and they see a vision in the distance that they're going for, and you land when you find it.
Yeah.
And it's...
I appreciate that.
Very cool to hear. I'm curious, what advice would you give someone? You said be adaptable, but what other advice would you give someone who's coming into this profession and just deer in the headlights, where do I go from here?
Coming into the profession, not starting a business?
We'll do both.
Okay, coming into the profession. I would say avoid the temptation of going to a nice, cushy, big firm.
What a description.
Because it is nice. It is fluffy, it is exciting, it is glamorous, but you likely won't be a holistic architect. Your practice won't be comprehensive because you'll be niche. If you're already good in design, you're going to be a designer. If you're already good at details, you're going to be doing details. And it's very rare to find a firm who puts training the professionals as a priority above profitability. Even if the managers and the principals are good humans, there is a headquarters back in whatever. They are looking at numbers like, you know.
It's such a strong structure. And they're asking you, which ladder do you want to climb? Do you want to be a detailer? Do you want to be a manager? Or do you want to be an architect? And it's like, all? How do I do all?
Exactly. I would say go find a small firm that's functional. Maybe you're not the second staff. Maybe you are part of a 5 to 10 people. You will have to be everything. You're going to hurt, you're going to suck, but in 2-3 years, you're going to know exactly what you're good at now, actually good at and passionate about. Okay, maybe you are good at design, but you actually prefer doing CDs and being the construction site. You won't know if you don't try. So if you go through that painful 3 years of your first, the beginning of your life, then you know what you want to do. You're not being told you have to do this. I would do that. I would go to the painful 3 years of having to do everything, even the things you hate doing. So you are a comprehensive architect later. You can tell I am full architect. I'm not just this or that. And then for people getting into the business, don't think too much. Just do it. If you do the math, you might not do it. So if you feel it's a calling, if you feel this is strong in your heart, if getting a job makes you more nervous than starting a business in a way of anxiety, like I had more anxiety about taking a job than starting my business at that point in my career, because the anxiety was based on my past experience with trying to climb this ladder that keeps being removed from me. And then the comfort of knowing I have no money, but I can do this for myself and try. It was more comforting to me. So that's what I follow. So if that is your heart, if you have this peace in your heart, regardless of what your circumstances are, follow that. And you can always get a job later if it doesn't work out.
That's so true.
Your ego is going to be slightly bruised, but that's all.
Yeah.
It's not bad at all. It's just that bruised ego. We can all survive that.
It's incredible what you learn about all aspects of practice. And to your point of generalizing, some of those aspects you can't learn, especially if it's in a small firm who's very uncomfortable sharing their books or uncomfortable sharing certain aspects of business. You almost just have to go out and figure it out.
Yeah.
And there are so many resources and people in the community that you can talk to. There's resources. Like, who was your resource when you were starting your business? How did you figure it out? Who did you call for that?
I didn't have anybody. I still don't. I have asked folks that are retired to help me review fees. Everybody's very uncomfortable with that. They feel like you as liability. Like, I'm not asking to sign anything. I never found that sound like a sounding board of, is my fee okay? Oh, it's too high. Is it too low? I don't have that. I don't have a mentor, a business mentor in the industry. Wish I had. I don't. So if anybody out there wants to be my mentor,
there we go.
I'm taking up mentors.
But you haven't stopped from mentoring other folks.
No, I haven't. And I really let my team, like my team make their prayer proposals of like, you have to know me, especially my PM. You have to write the proposals because guess what? You are managing the team later. So you need to know how many fee you need for phase 1, 2, 3, 4. And if you, of course I'll review and I'll say, too skinny here, too much there, or need more everywhere. But it's better that you really have that sense of, oh yeah, I was way off. And if we both make a mistake again, we won't forget it, that lesson. Because if you had to pay to complete the project, trust me, next one, we're going to make sure that we are diligent on figuring out what it really takes.
Yeah, it's so hard when it's a verboten topic and it doesn't need to be. We've just been so scared away from it since, 1990, the lawsuits back then. I was, 2 years old when that happened. And like, I'm coming into the profession, like, what? What are you talking about?
Talk about fees.
These generational trauma from talking about fees. So,
yeah. And I wish I could. I mean, if somebody asked me, I'll tell them what.
Yeah.
Is this fee too high?
Yeah.
I have advised interior designers who started our practices and came to me with fees. They were like, ooh, this is like way out there, more than the structural engineer or MEP. So let's downsize it. If you can, if you don't want to, that's fine. I have given my opinion on that. Interior designers, they're not as stiff as architects with that. But I understand there's a legality about it. But I feel like it doesn't serve anybody.
Yeah.
Including our clients. I don't know how that serves our clients either.
It can make it hard for them to compare and understand what are our services worth. What is the value of an architect for your project? Especially, like you said at the beginning, when you're meeting with someone with curiosity and you just have to ask them, what do you need? Because I don't know what you need yet. I need to find out more.
Mm-hmm.
How do you even put a number value to that experience? And
yeah,
even more challenging when you're working with developers who are crunching the numbers and they've got you've said you found developers who have more purpose behind what they're doing, but they do need their projects to be profitable.
Oh yeah. Performance are real things. They have to perform. Yeah,
absolutely. So yeah, it's just having those conversations and showing your worth and showing your value, which can be exhausting to always be on and always be presenting that to others. Well, is there anything else, Damaris?
No, I think we covered a lot of things. It's exciting to be here. I think we do need more people to take the leap of faith, and especially women, and come out here and play with us, the entrepreneurs.
I love it. I love seeing the different ways people practice. Is there anything that is the wildest way you've seen someone start a firm that you're like, that is so interesting? I could never do it that way.
Wildest because of they decided to do, or wildest because of the way they did it?
Maybe the way they did it.
Well, I don't think anybody. I mean, my way was pretty wild. I was recently divorced, so I had a nice job that I thought I could count on. So I just gave up the house and I gave up all this stuff, you know, because I have a big, nice job. So I don't need that. I can build it again. And then I got my business. The business I was part of went out of business. So 6 months after, I was renting and then I lost the big job. And I had very little to my name because, again, I had given up 40% of my 401k, you know, divorce in Minnesota. And I was very unstable. And then I had 5K to my name and I was renting. And if you have rented, you know, 12 days after the rent is due, you get the letter under your door. I don't know how I know that. But I went for it because, again, the peace in my heart was so strong. Contrast to the anxiety of getting a job with benefits. So I think the wildest thing that I've ever done in my life was to go into a business without any backup plan, any place to fall back on, and a daughter. And I had a daughter and I was renting. So I couldn't pass my rent date by more than 15 days. And following that voice in my heart, that was way, way softer than the loudest of the loudest voices outside of my head, which was my circumstances and my financial situation. So I felt like it's just such a weird contrast. This piece about the craziest idea that could ever be that makes no sense, and anxiety about this nicely packaged option. So that was what made me sure.
Yeah, it's not always a clean slate when you're starting your own business. It can come out of the mess. And look, 7 years in, how does it feel to be pausing and think about where you're at compared to that start?
Oh my gosh, it feels like best thing, wildest thing I've ever had. Wildest thing I've ever done, best thing I've ever done at the same time. It has not been easy at all, but I would not want to do it differently. You know, it gets harder in different ways. It does not get easier, but it gets more rewarding. It's hard to explain. It's almost like motherhood. I don't know. It's hard to explain.
It is. It's making you a different person. And
yes,
it's incredible. It's incredible to talk with you now about this and where you are with everything and just what a journey you've had, Damaris. Thank you so much for sharing this.
Thank you. And I appreciate you. And I know you helped me in the very beginning.
I do remember.
You were doing some side gigs and you're doing some drawings and some rendering.
That was a fun. Yeah. Also, when I was getting my start and I didn't know where work came from and you were right there like, hey, I need this. And it's like, oh, work, I can work. Yes, I can do that.
Yes. And it was a fun interaction. And that project is not just now being funded, by the way.
Are you serious? Oh, I'm going to have to look that up. That's very exciting.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We are now going to entitlements because it's now finally being funded. Yeah.
So
it's
cool.
Been a journey. But since mission-driven projects often are, so we need to be resilient and have endurance for those.
So true. There's money that needs to be changing hands, but yeah, multi-year projects and long-term relationships, it's hard to put a monetary value on that when you're just starting off and just writing that proposal, you know?
Oh, yeah.
So I really appreciate you sharing all of that journey with us.
Thank you, Katie. Thank you for inviting me. Appreciate it.
Damaris has an inspiring practice. She broke from the pattern of practice by tackling big projects as a small firm. She was an accidental entrepreneur, ultimately choosing to start her own firm after realizing she couldn't achieve her goals within someone else's business structure. She built her practice to be more inclusive, intentionally shaping a culture that reflects her own values. And she infuses her passion into her team and her clients' projects. And her practice reminds me of a jabiru, one of the largest flying birds in the Americas. When it stands in the wetlands, it is unmistakable. And it naturally commands attention. It would never hide inside a smaller flock. And that's our first takeaway. Don't shrink to fit into a smaller role. Being a small firm or a sole practitioner does not limit you to small projects. Damaris didn't set out to start a small firm. She stepped into entrepreneurship to fully live out her calling. Through her business, she can tackle urban redevelopment and provide affordable housing. And through that, she's able to help transform communities, even when that change is uncomfortable. Her projects stir conversations and they rattle the long-standing traditions of some neighborhoods, and they stand out like that jabiru in the wetland. But Damaris skillfully navigates those community conversations, particularly when discussions become politically charged or emotionally heavy. She meets that opposition and gently redirects the dialogue toward a shared vision of the future. Damaris continues to bravely articulate a greater vision for communities through urban redevelopment and other affordable housing projects. And in that distinction, she has found it easier to identify and align with her ideal clients. She's able to find partners and contractors who value the long-term impact of their work on community redevelopment. And that's our second takeaway: to own your own look and own your own voice, to find resonance with ideal clients. Ajabiru stands nearly shoulder height to an average human. Its long black beak and red neck collar set it apart from almost any other bird. Damaris also has a distinctive silhouette to her practice. She built her firm to express her values: curiosity, inclusivity, and fun. These words deeply describe her approach to projects and collaboration, so that when she launched Design by Mello, she doubled down on who she serves best. And those clients align with her own mission and her own passion. They're the ones who care about community impact. They don't just drain her time and energy. They feed into the reason why she chose architecture in the first place. And when you become more fully yourself and you come into your own, you become easier to recognize. And that recognition attracts clients who see their values reflected in your practice. And the challenge is finding where those clients resonate with you, which has led Damaris to thoughtfully broaden her geographic region to reach more clients that she can serve. And that's our third takeaway: migrate to where your clients are. The Jabiru will migrate through diverse ecosystems, from southern Mexico to northern Argentina. It adapts to wetlands, floodplains, and many shifting conditions. Damaris has adapted her practice to migrate across state lines. She reduces barriers so that she can serve her ideal clients wherever they are. Her license is not going to be an obstacle for her clients. She carries that responsibility herself so that her time with clients can focus fully on their project and their challenges, and discussing inclusive urban redevelopment. These conversations are happening in cities across the country, and Damaris understands this. And she is ready to adapt to whatever environment her client is in. She is going to stay attuned to the underlying dynamics of each unique community. So this is where we land: that you need to stand tall enough to carry meaningful work and be distinctive enough to be recognized for what you truly value. And be adaptable so that you can serve clients where they need you most. You know, architecture really sticks out, and Damaris is willing to put herself out there as well. And she's willing to help reshape urban environments. And she can do that in a small firm. But small doesn't mean little. It means focused. And through her focus, she is making a big impact in the lives of people in and around her urban redevelopment projects. Season 2 of the Flying Solo podcast is sponsored by the Minnesota Architectural Foundation, whose mission is to invest in excellence, leadership, discovery, and equity within the profession of architecture. To join the Flying Solo movement, visit the website flyingsolo.live, that's flyingsolo.live, for links to our Instagram, Substack, and the Wingbeat newsletter, a weekly dose of birdspiration and practical tips to help you grow your business and your confidence as a solopreneur architect. While you're there, take the bird quiz to discover which bird best matches your solopreneur style. For even more resources and encouragement, you can find all the Flying Solo episodes on the Gable Media platform at gablemedia.com. That's gablemedia.com, the premier destination for podcasts about architecture and design. And if you're looking for community, connection, and real conversations, check out the Entree Architect Network at entrearchitect.com. There's a link in the show notes. Whether you join one of their masterclasses or the free Facebook group, you'll find a community of small firm architects sharing ideas, challenges, and wins, proving that while we may work solo, we're never alone. As Mark R. LePage, founder of Entree Architect, says, it's all about doing better practice and better work every day. Thank you for listening to Flying Solo. I'm Katie Kangas, and my hope is to empower you, aspiring architects and creative entrepreneurs, to soar to new heights and embrace the freedom of flying solo.